Welcome, everybody, to a Baseball America podcast. I'm John Manuel. I'm joined from Arizona by J.J. Cooper. I'm joined from Massachusetts by Ben Badler. A World Baseball Classic power podcast. Those two guys have already covered WBC games. I'm on my way to cover the semifinals and finals in San Francisco on Friday. So we're not all WBC all the time, but it's felt that way for a couple of weeks for the three of us. And we're going to talk a lot about what Ben saw in Japan with Team Japan and obviously Cuba, J.J.'s observations from Phoenix with the U.S., the brawl, all that went on down there. But let's start off, guys, with the game that's on tap tomorrow as we record this. It's the Pool 2, really the showdown. And for the first time in three World Baseball Classics, we'll get to see the United States against the Dominican Republic. And Ben, I'll start with you. I mean, the Dominican doesn't necessarily have all of its stars because they don't have Johnny Cueto and probably a couple outfielders you would take. Your optimal Dominican team would not have Ricardo Nonita in the outfield corner. But this is still a devastating Dominican lineup, and they've played very well. They're the only undefeated team in the WBC. What's your take on this game, and what's your take on the way the Dominican team has played to this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would think the U.S. would probably be the favorite to win not just this game, but probably the whole tournament. Between, you know, not just, you know, the lineup, I think the Dominican Republic can match, they can match the U.S. on the lineup when you have, you know, Jose Reyes and Hanley Ramirez and Robinson Cano, you know, Nelson Cruz, all these guys. That's pretty powerful lineup. The problem is that there's a state of Dominican starting pitching. You mentioned Johnny Cueto's not there. You know, if they had him, it might be a different story, but, you know, that's just what scouts talk about all the time. They go to the Dominican Republic and they're scouting guys, and it's, you know, a lot of guys who can, you know, throw really hard, but a lot of times the field, a spin, a breaking ball isn't there, and the pitchability isn't there. It just doesn't seem to develop a lot of times. It actually makes Wandy Rodriguez, you know, really stand out in that regard, especially being a left-handed guy. But yeah, I mean, you talk about guys who aren't there. I mean, even for starting pitchers, they're going to throw Samuel Deduno out there. It's not like, you know, they have Volquez, but I mean, who else would you know, who else is missing? I mean, do you want Francisco Liriano out there or Ubaldo Jimenez or, you know, Ivan Nova or Irvin Santana? It's not like there's a wide array of, you know, quality starting pitchers to choose from.
It really is amazing, Ben, when you look at, and that's a story idea we're working on for the year. And JJ, you and I talked about it in the podcast this winter. I mean, the Dominican Republic and pitchability, they just don't go together. And, you know, it's not a strength of the Dominican team. That said, the bullpen is a strength of this Dominican team. It feels like if the Duno can give them three or four serviceable innings against the U.S., I mean, you picked the Dominican to win the whole tournament, JJ, and correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you did it because their bullpen is so stacked.
The bullpen and the lineup, and I do think the one thing that stands out with this game is that this is not a must-win game for the Dominican. And that's the key thing about of getting the win in the first game, is that they can lose this one. And really, in the grand scheme, as long as they beat Italy, they beat the winner of Italy-Puerto Rico,
right,
which is playing, then they can advance. So, and then once you get to the, you know, it's still going to be an issue for them, really, kind of, you know, anywhere in this tournament. But, but I do think that their lineup is good enough. And we've seen, really, the one thing that Sam Deduno gives you at least a little bit of is some unfamiliarity for some of the guys. There is some advantage to that maybe too. But no, I think you got to like the U.S. chances in this game. And the argument against putting R.A. Dickey on the mound against Mexico kind of goes away in this one, is in that you really don't worry that the Dominican Republic bats are going to be slow bats that have trouble getting around on good fastball. That's not really an issue with a lot of those guys.
That's what I was going to ask you, JJ. I mean, you'd made that great point, I thought, in Phoenix, that scouts were saying, you know, Mexico as a collective, that team was not a team of bat speed guys. It was a team where, you know, guys like Karim Garcia, I don't know him, I don't respect him. You know, guys like that who are going to beat you with strength, not bat speed, not whippy bat speed. You would not say that, obviously, about the Dominican Republic team. And it really, I have to say, guys, it's, you know, the things the Dominican that people are talking about with the Dominican team nationally are, you know, that they're 4-0 and the talent in their lineup. and then the exuberance. It's a different style. I mean, everyone keeps talking about it. I don't know, Ben, JJ, I'll start with you, Ben. I mean, do you have any issue with the way the Dominican plays the game? I mean, Robbie Cano kind of complaining about Nick Punto's hard slides. I mean, it's kind of like a college atmosphere, the way they celebrate home runs and runs. For me, I'll be honest with you, I love it. I love seeing Jose Reyes cheerlead and go nuts. I love seeing the passion of the Dominican players on display in the WBC. I really don't have a problem with it, but it seems like some other people do.
Well, the real question is, what angle is Fernando Rodney's hat going to be at by the end of the tournament?
Backwards.
Yeah. I don't know if that's maybe that's got to be some mechanical adjustment that the Rays made to, I don't know, maybe get him better balance or something. But, yeah, I don't care. I like seeing them celebrate. It's fun. It's March.
Exactly.
I like seeing them get into it. It's a lot more entertaining than, some spring training game where the results really don't matter. I like seeing them celebrate. If you do that in, May or something where you're going to face a team again, you might have to face some repercussions down the line. But, in this game, especially compared to, the antics, the celebrations, I don't have an issue with that, especially compared to what the Cuban team does, those guys were, they'd throw, it'd be a two strike pitch and there would be not even a borderline pitch, a pitch off the plate and the catcher would, frame the ball and then he wouldn't even frame the ball. He would just start walking off the field and the pitcher would start walking off the field. Oh, wait, that's a ball. All right, fine. We'll come back. I mean, that gets a little bit tiresome and grating, but yeah, I don't have an issue with what the Dominican celebrations were.
I'm gonna use that as a jumping off point because I do want to talk to you a little bit about Team Cuba. The Dominican and the U.S. are obviously still alive in Pool 2. We've had Japan and the Netherlands, to use the March parlance, punch their tickets for San Francisco out of Pool 1. Obviously a surprise, I think, even though, JJ, you and I talked in the prelims and before the tournament about my affectation for the Netherlands and how much I like that team. And I wouldn't be surprised even if they won the whole thing. So I'm not totally surprised they're going to San Francisco. I am surprised they beat the Cubans twice. I wasn't surprised that the way they did it, that they were kind of gritty and not intimidated by Cuba because they had beaten them before in other international tournaments. Going back to 2000 in Sydney when Rickard Fenite came out of center field and got the save against a tremendous Cuban team in the Olympics to the 2011 World Cup. But I do think Cuba not advancing is a pretty big shock. What was your take, JJ, just of watching them from afar before Ben? And if you have questions for Ben about Team Cuba, I'd love to hear your what you want to know from Ben. But what were your impressions?
I was going to say, because one thing I do want to ask Ben is what did he think about Victor Mesa's managing style, which it seems like, I mean, you want to talk about living and dying on every pitch in the, in March. It felt like with him, it was like if a pitcher threw a bad pitch, he knew he might be taken out of the game. I mean, it wasn't a bad outing. It wasn't a bad at bat even. It was, threw a bad pitch. Okay, well, he could, you might be gone. But I do think that what we saw a lot of is kind of what we talked about in the preview is, pitching-wise, they're just not nearly as intimidating as they used to be. And I thought that actually the pitching was maybe a little bit better than maybe, we thought going in. But, I would love to hear Ben, since he saw him firsthand. It just seems like that the hitting, was still there. But pitching-wise, they really miss some of the guys that they've lost to the U.S. And they also just haven't developed enough pitching lately.
Yeah, they don't have – I mean, it's hard to replace Chapman. There's nobody in the world like Chapman. But they don't have even somebody like an El Duque or a Levon Hernandez, Jose Contreras, somebody like that to carry the team. They're throwing out guys. And remember, these are the best of the best guys in Cuba. And their best pitchers, Vladimir Garcia, he was, 92, 94 – kind of, a sweepy kind of slider, but it was effective. He has a good arm, although he did get hit around somewhat. But after that, I mean, you're seeing a lot of guys throwing 87, 89. They brought in the lefty Gonzalez for, long relief, but he was, throwing, I think he threw 100% sliders.
Yeah, it looked like it.
It was just, they're just throwing junk baller after junk baller. It's just not, Gerardo, think how bad Gerardo Concepcion was this past year. He probably would have been on that team. He might have even gotten a start for them. I don't know. But, the pitching for Cuba, we knew going in that their strength was going to be the lineup. Huge power. It was a lot of fun watching BP or watching guys like Alfredo Despaigne and Jose Abreu and Yosmani Tomas coming out and showing their power. But the pitching I think the pitching cost them a lot, and I think that a lot of the overmanaging cost them. Not only is it grating to watch the manager come out to the mound almost every single inning, if not multiple times per inning. That really drags the game on and makes it unenjoyable to watch this kind of unnecessary mound trips constantly and all these pitching changes. But, all these, we wrote about it yesterday, all the bunts that they were doing from guys, bunting with two strikes, bunting with guys like Gurriel, who clearly don't really know how to bunt. If you want to teach them how to bunt, that's, I guess, go ahead, but this really isn't the opportunity for that. So I think they sort of manage themselves out of the game.
Yeah, Ben, it really seemed like, and we talked about this off air yesterday, so I'm making on air now so it actually counts. But I really thought that watching yesterday, that asking Ulesky Gurriel to bunt in the seventh inning was the worst move of the whole tournament, because Gurriel was having a great game. He already had two doubles. He's, a two-time MVP in Serie Nacional. He's a veteran of that national team. And he didn't get the button down. The inning went away. As so many others, as you detailed very well, the inning dissipated where you give the other team an out and you don't score. And it seemed like all the momentum in the game after that point went to the Netherlands. You had the Simmons game-tying home run in the eighth. You had Gurriel with a base running, I guess Mesa would say gaff. I would say safe base running when you have Frederick Cepeda and Jose Abreu coming to the plate. But Mesa went berserk in the dugout when Gurriel didn't score from second on the single by Fernandez. And then you had Gurriel making the error in the ninth inning. It seemed like that failed bunt, and the way his manager was on him for it, did not help him perform. In fact, I think it hindered his performance, and he helped. I think that guy's the GOAT. And I don't mean greatest of all time. He's wearing the goat horns for Cuba, and I wonder what the long-term ramifications will be for Ulesky Gurriel on that team. It's not like they couldn't plug in Hector Oliveira at third base if they think he's not a flight risk with Fernandez playing second. And you said Gurriel had the. So that was my take on that game. You also said that Gurriel and Abreu and several of the great Cuban players, and they are some great talents, had a little bit funk in their swings. There were some things that you noticed. So I wanted you maybe to talk a little bit about that, kind of the swing of Gurriel and the play of maybe if you wanted to break down Gurriel, Abreu, your take and some of the preliminary talk you had with some scouts, and then kind of Tomas, Yosmani Tomas, it seems like he's kind of the breakout talent, maybe the guy that was a good Cuban player that maybe got a little bit more exposure and became a bigger name after this tournament.
Yeah, well, we just talked about the pitching in Cuba, and I think it's had an effect. It has an effect on the hitters where it leads to some bad habits from the hitters. Yeah, you can see guys like Gurriel and Despaigne, those guys, especially Despaigne, just unbelievable bat speed, but I don't think you really need a sharp scouting eye to notice that he's got a lot of things in his swing that you probably wouldn't want to teach. There's length there. There's a little bit of a hitch. He's not really a short, compact swing. He just tries to hit a home run pretty much every time he swings a bat.
Yeah.
Gurriel too. He just has great hand-eye coordination, really good bat speed. He's got power, a good hitting approach, but, he's angling the bat towards center field. It creates a lot of length in the swing, which, okay, if you're a U.S. scout and you're trying to evaluate him, from the perspective of, all right, well, if he ever comes out and we have to project this guy out in the major leagues, is that going to translate? For him, it's not really a concern because, if you have a longer swing, maybe the bat speed is still there and the hand-eye coordination is so good that it still works. But especially if you're facing guys in Cuba where, the best guy is really just kind of tickling the low 90s at best. Most of the guys you're facing are throwing, a bunch of mid-80s fastballs, maybe the high 80s. It doesn't really matter. So you can get away with a lot of bad habits there. Even Abreu is, he's a great hitter, but, his hands work really well, but he's got kind of a weird toe tap and he sort of cuts himself off, leaves himself vulnerable to inside fastballs and had some issues with breaking balls too. But the hitting acumen that he has and the power that he has are just tremendous, and he can get away with it in Cuba. Whereas, if he's going to go face major league pitching for 162 games, those things might not work, or it might just be that he hasn't had the chance to, he hasn't been forced to make those adjustments yet. So you don't know if he's going to make those adjustments. That's one of the challenges for scouts.
JJ, what was your take you didn't have a chance to have that discussion, but I thought Ben made a great point yesterday because in Japan, you see some of these different hitting styles because there's not a parade of velocity. So you see some of these leg kicks, some of the pronounced stances, and you see a little bit of that out of Japan, out of Cuba as well, and I think that you make a great point, Ben. The two have to be related. Because you can get away with an exaggerated stance like that when you're not facing the kind of velocity you face in the American professional leagues.
I will actually argue one point. I somewhat agree with that. I think with some of the stances you see in Japan, I would disagree. Like when you talk about a hitch or you talk about a long swing, I think that is something that you get into bad habits because of the lack of premium velocity. I think in Japan, I would actually argue that a lot of that is the different stances and all you see, because a lot of it's in setup. It's not in the swing. It's in the setup. And that, I think, you could argue in many ways is because the personal training at age 8 and the showcase environment that we have here in the U.S. now has not translated over to Japan. You used to see a lot more of that in the U.S. But really what's happened now stance-wise is we've become a lot more cookie-cutter because, it's something where most players have gotten instruction for many, many years, so they didn't develop their own style. They basically were taught, here's how here's your stance. And I do think with the Japan players, some of them, they're not. It's a contact-oriented approach because they don't have a whole lot of power, and the kind of strange stance, is kind of more what's comfortable for them. But I think there are things that some of the guys do that, would be a problem against premium velocity. But I think some of it's just there's a little bit more individuality to your setup in Japan than there is here in the U.S.
That's interesting as well. I do think there's some cookie-cutterness. We were talking in the office the other day, Ben. I don't think you were here, but. I think it was after you left, but the batting stance guy, fewer unique guys for batting stance guy to do, but I think he would have a field day in Japan. So.
Yeah, if you saw, I think Sakamoto is probably one of the best Japanese players. He's only 24 years old, but he's got the swing in terms of length. He's a pretty compact swing, and he's got some power, especially for an infielder, but it's... That leg kick, he's practically brings his leg out and then he rotates it counterclockwise. I think at one point his foot is over the plate. There's something to be said for, doing what's comfortable for you and finding your own hitting approach. But I can't imagine that feels natural for him or why somebody would teach him to do that. Because by the time, that's the thing is I'm sure it works in Japan, where you're not seeing the same caliber of stuff that you're going to see in the major leagues. If you're facing, Clayton Kershaw or even just, some middle reliever in the U.S. who pretty much all throw in the mid-90s now, if you have to gear up for that and be prepared for at least one good off-speed pitch, you're going to have all sorts of timing issues trying to catch up to that and being able to stay balanced and stay back on the off-speed stuff.
I just think it's fascinating stuff. Obviously, we did a top 20 prospect after the last WBC. Ben and JJ are going to kind of coordinating that already. And top 20 prospects who we can go 10, we can go 20, we probably go 30. If we went 30, I'd say 28 of them would be Cubans, maybe. Well, not 28, but be a lot of Cubans. Ben, you talked about the batting practice of the Cuban players. Again, I think that's part of the intimidation factor. And it seemed like it worked against Japan in the game that you saw them play in Fukuoka. What do you think changed for Team Japan between that lackluster performance they put together in Fukuoka where they edged Brazil and China and then kind of got handled by Cuba, and then went in the second round where they were able to beat Taiwan in a tight game and then just annihilate the Netherlands twice, really, 26 runs off the Dutch pitchers. What changed for Team Japan? Was it as simple as getting Shunosuke Abe healthier and up in more situations where he could do some damage? Because he seems like he's by far their most physical power hitter.
Yeah, Abe is a big-time hitter for them. He's going to be their most dangerous offensive weapon in San Francisco. You know, they were kind of lackluster in Fukuoka. I didn't think they were all that great in Tokyo. In the first game they played against Taiwan, you know, they didn't light it up. You know, I think they ran into, you know, Rob Kordemans, and the Netherlands was leaning on him, but he just didn't have it.
Yeah.
That day, and then the bullpen, they just weren't really facing quality arms the rest of that first game against the Netherlands. They did turn it on in the second game. I'll give them that against the Netherlands. But the offense, you know, they don't have the same offensive firepower that they did in 2006 or in 2009. Abe is a dangerous hitter. Sakamoto, it's going to be interesting to see how he fares against better pitching. They've got some, you know, solid hitters in the lineup, but you know, they certainly don't have the thumpers that that Cuba has. Abe is definitely going to be the guy to watch in San Francisco. You know, older guy, so from a prospect standpoint, maybe not the guy that scouts are going to be looking at. Although I do think he could play in the major leagues, but in terms of Japan having a chance to win the World Baseball Classic, I think he's going to be a big figure for them going forward.
JJ, what's your takeaway between Japan and Netherlands from Pool 1? I mean, which team is Japan, the two-time champions, and they're back in the Final Four? I mean, even without their major leaguers, do you think Japan is the favorite? I mean, are they the in the Ric Flair parlance, I mean, to be the man, you got to beat the man. Is Japan still the man?
Japan's still the man. I don't think they can be the favorite, because I do think that we've seen with the U.S., even with their kind of little bit of struggles, that they, especially when we saw what Gio Gonzalez did, I think you probably point to the U.S. as the favorite. The thing that was encouraging to me for Japan was that Maeda came back and threw much better. And that gives them, if they've got Tanaka and Maeda, that's a much better situation. Both of them throwing well, that's a much better situation than they had when they were in Fukuoka, when Ben saw them. I did want to also ask Ben one thing, which is, Ben, were you surprised that it appears that the Cuban team left, went to Japan, came back, and it seems like everyone on the Cuban team is still on the Cuban team?
Yeah, I guess, you know, there haven't been defections really at the World Baseball Classics. So I guess I'm not too surprised about that. And there's obviously some rumors about some guys might leave. But, yeah, anytime these guys leave Cuba, you never know. There's a chance some of them might run away. But it seems like more and more for whatever reason, these guys are it's easier, I would think, to walk away at one of these international tournaments. I guess it depends on what country you're in terms of whether it's, you know, how advantageous it is to leave, but for whatever reason, these guys seem to be trusting their lives to, you know, these guys who are smuggling them out of Cuba, and it's not very safe, obviously, but these guys are taking those risks. A lot of them are getting caught and getting punished for it, and even the ones who are making it over successfully are running into a lot of danger, so it's just a dicey situation.
I think dicey is the... I mean, that's the professional way to put it. It's the Baseball America podcast with John, Ben, and JJ. And JJ, let's transition a little bit to the other side. We still have four teams alive in Pool 2 as we record this. Italy and Puerto Rico getting ready to play an elimination game. Correct me if disagree with me, if you will, JJ, but I think that this Pool 2 is a much, much bigger separation than Pool 1 was. I think the U.S. and Dominican, with the exception of Ricardo Nanita, these are two lineups full of big leaguers, and Italy and Puerto Rico are some big leaguers, some minor leaguers, some foreign league players, I would say, like, you know, Japan or Korean leaguers or even Italian leaguers. But there's a pretty big gap.
Oh, in Italy's case, no leaguers last year, one case.
Anthony Granato,
they're short stuff.
Yeah, but
he played the European Cup. But
I would say that Italy and the Puerto Rican and Italian teams are, I think, there's a big gap between their talent and the U.S. and Dominican teams. That's how I feel about it. What would your take? Let's talk a little bit about Italy, actually, because I'm going to give you a chance to wax eloquent about Chris Colabello, your 2011 Independent Player of the Year, who's kind of the feel-good story about this. But how big of a shock was it to you to be out in Phoenix and to see Italy win its first two games in advance? And do you think that using all these passport guys like Colabello and like Anthony Rizzo and like Nick Punto, does that help? Is that good for the WBC in the long run, or a hindrance? Because it seems like it does turn some fans off.
Yeah, but the fans I think it turns off are the same fans who just want to complain about the WBC and they're looking for something to complain about.
I agree with you.
I think in that case, I mean, this Italy team is, you know, there are passport players. Some of them are more passporty than others. Like in the case of like Colabello, you know, his mom's Italian. He, you know, and he's lived in Italy at times, and he speaks Italian. You know, that to me, you know, that doesn't feel to me like a guy who goes, hey, can do you want to wear Team Italy uniform? I mean, this is the guy who before he signed a pro contract with the Twins, you know, affiliated contract, he was talking about how he's going to go play in the Italian league at some point. You know, he's looking forward to that at some point at the very tail end of his career. And there's a lot of pitchers on this team. I mean, they did really, I mean, if you say, okay, they did win in large part, because of the middle of their lineup, which was one flat out. Alex Liddy is completely Italian, first Italian big leaguer. Anthony Rizzo is not. He's more of a passport player. That's a key thing for them to get there. But at the same time, a lot of their success, surprisingly, was because of pitchers from the Italian league. And, you know, to me, yes, you are putting some passport guys around them so that, you know, that's representative team. But I thought I know it's good for baseball in Italy. Because talking to, you know, people involved with baseball in Italy, they were saying how that this would be very important for baseball in Italy. It would get, you know, some added attention for what really has been, I mean, because of the economy in Italy in general, it's been a pretty tough time for the Italian Baseball League. And this is going to be a boost for it. And that's exactly what the World Baseball Classic is supposed to be. So it's good to see that happen to me. And see, to me, the fact that you have the Netherlands in the semifinals and you have Italy playing in the second round is huge for baseball in Europe. And it's an inspiration for Germany and some of the other countries who, you know, who are kind of growing baseball there to say, you know, hey, here, look, here, there's a goal to shoot for.
Also, JJ, just talk, you got to talk a little bit about Colabello. I mean, this guy's got two home runs in four games. He's got the air kiss scene around the world with him and Anthony Rizzo, which was just hilarious. My favorite celebration of the WBC. Talk a little bit about him and his career and kind of what this, you know, he stamped himself. I mean, he went oppo, three-run homer off Edison Volquez about 10 rows back at Marlins Park. That's a big league thing to do for Chris Colabello. I mean, this guy's story is pretty unique.
Yeah, I'm ashamedly a Chris Colabello fan. I mean, where do you start? He 7-year independent league career, hitting over 300 each and every one of those 7 years, never signed a pro contract, and stuck with it. As I had multiple players themselves tell me, it's like, and scouts say, 7 years? How did he stick with it? 7 years. And you know, they just tip their cap. Like, I mean, it's amazing that you would be willing to do that and not give up on your dream. So signs with the Twins. He had a really good year last year in Double A, and then, you know, goes out and really has the World Baseball Classic to dream of. I mean, to go from 1 year ago, not knowing if you're ever going to get a chance to play affiliated ball, to playing in big league stadiums against big league pitchers and not just holding your own, but succeeding, you know, but really being a key part of one of the more improbable runs in World Baseball Classic history. It's hard to imagine kind of a better story than that. And the thing about it is that you also can't help but think that this is going to be key for him going forward too, because he's going to head to AAA. I mean, that's where he's going to go. He's going to be head to AAA for the Twins this year. And if there is ever a point this year, you know, where they're like, hey, we need to bring a guy up, this is a case where I do think that the World Baseball Classic performance has helped him, because I think it is something that the Twins see, and it's like, okay, you file that away. I know with a lot of guys, they say, you know, didn't want to leave to go to the WBC because they were fighting for job, big league jobs, and that was going to hurt them. I understand that. This is a guy who wasn't fighting for a big league job. But what he's done in a week of the World Baseball Classic is way more than he could have done in a week in Twins camp, to me. I would love to think hear what y'all think about that, but to me that's pretty clear.
Yeah, I'm
but it's not like, you know, it's not like he just, you know, scraped by in Double A last year either. You know, I know he was 28. Obviously, like you said, it took him 7 years just to get to that point. But you know, he put up good numbers in the Eastern League last year.
And not only that, but as I told JJ, when I was doing Twins calls for the top 30, and you know, you're going over these things with their farm director and with their field coordinator, these guys in the system about best defensive infielder. Joe Leppel just said, he said, what's the shortstop, the veteran guy? Pedro Florimon. I told him, well, he doesn't qualify. His next name out of his mouth was Chris Colabello. He said, this guy's really good around first base. I know you don't normally say a first baseman for best defensive infielder, but I might say Chris Colabello. Now, I wound up going in another direction. I forget who I picked because I didn't want to pick a first baseman. But it just tells you a little bit of the show of respect he has earned in that organization, and I think he's an option for them. And I think with Justin Morneau's contract, with their rebuilding, if Morneau has a good gets off to a good start this year, and we've talked about in other podcasts the lack of offense at first base in the major leagues right now, the possibility of playing Joe Mauer more at first base on the line, I think it's possible Colabello is a transition guy for the Twins, especially now that you see Trevor Plouffe having this calf strain in spring training. Frankly, Trevor Plouffe, outside of Josh Willingham, is their top right-handed power guy. And obviously, Willingham's one. Plouffe is their next right-handed power guy. I think when you're a rebuilding team at the big league level, they could do a lot worse than play Chris Colabello some. So I think he's shown to me that he deserves a big league shot. And I think he showed some of that last year. But like you said, Ben, you could just kind of chalk it up to 28-year-old Double A. He's perfect for what the WBC is about. It gives him a chance to play in a pressure situation, and I think we'll see it again with some of the younger pitchers. You saw it, JJ, with Jameson Taillon in Phoenix.
Oh, I think
we all knew Jameson Taillon's a stud, but to really measure that, how much of a stud could he be? Well, you saw it. I mean, it's spring training, but four innings against a big league team, a big league lineup like that, he competed and he had frontline stuff.
And the thing about it is that's something that for his development is going to be huge, because now he knows I can. It's one thing to face guys, and yeah, you can face big league spring training, but you also know in the back of your head, even as a pitcher, okay, I faced them, but you know they weren't. I mean, it's spring training. This is different. He faced big league hitters, a really not just a big league lineup that would rank as one of the best, if not the best, big league lineup in baseball.
Right.
In a game that really mattered, and he succeeded. He thrived. You know, had a couple. I think Joe Torre helped him with a puzzling. I do think. I mean, we talked about the epidemic with Bunning. To give an out to a young pitcher who I really thought like that with Taillon, really what the risk you had is that if an inning started going poorly, it could fall apart pretty quickly. Well, it didn't, and I do think part of that is you give him an out when he doesn't. You know, what they don't have to work for. You just made his job a lot easier. But no, you saw the stuff. I mean, he didn't really. There was really a fastball curveball approach, but both of them looked really good. And the thing that did also stand out for a young pitcher is that he felt comfortable throwing his curveball behind in the count because he felt comfortable he could locate it, which was pretty impressive.
I thought he was very impressive, guys. We should wrap up soon, but impressions of Team USA, Ben. I mean, like, which is the worst managerial move? Victor Mesa, Bunning, Ulesky Gurriel, Jose Dariel Abreu, and Alfredo Despaigne, or is that trumped by Joe Torre batting Giancarlo Stanton eighth?
I mean, yeah, I can't imagine why you would want Stanton getting fewer bats than, you know, Jimmy Rollins and Brandon Phillips, but
Eric Hosmer.
Yeah, or Eric Hosmer. I guess maybe you want to break up the lefties and the righties or something like that, but I don't get too bogged down in
right.
batting order. What Cuba was doing was just silly. I mean, they're having their catcher bunt with two strikes. He can't do it. They have him do it again, try to bunt again. I think he popped out. I guess it got him on television a lot, got him talked about a lot. It's good for him. But I think it cost him the game and it cost him a trip to San Francisco.
I agree. I don't think it's worse than Joe Torre. At the same time, I am stunned by Joe Torre batting Giancarlo Stanton eight. And at the same time, it's almost like he's doing it, JJ, to prove how good this team is, because you have Stanton and Zobrist hitting eighth and ninth. And it has worked. Hosmer, actually, to his credit, has had a pretty decent WBC, and I thought he had did a nice job last night with that. When I showed Alex this morning, when we were watching WBC highlights and showed my son, hey, Eric Hosmer stole a base off Yadier Molina. He instantly just said, but Molina's a -4. He just went into strat talk immediately. So he thought, what's Hosmer? Hosmer can't be more than a C. But, but Hosmer was some savvy and scored from second after he stole the base. I mean, he had the big three-run hit against the break open that the game with Canada. But it still feels like the U.S. lineup is the strongest lineup in this event, and if they're going to start getting decent starting pitching like they got out of Gio Gonzalez, I feel like they are. They to me, they survived the first round, and after last night, they've kind of established themselves as the favorite as long as Dickey is better than he was in the first round.
I think they're the team.
I do think the thing to me that is the concern for the U.S. team is this. Okay, so how's your pitching going to set up? Because we go from this double elimination to a one and done. And I feel very comfortable if Gio Gonzalez is on the mound if you're the U.S. I feel pretty comfortable if Barry Dickey's on the mound if you're the U.S. The other two guys, I'm not so comfortable. And so we're going to get Dickey today. So that means we'll get Vogelsong if they win in the kind of seeding game. But does that set up? I mean, does that mean that you're going to see Derek Holland, who pitched okay, but you got Derek Holland in the semifinal game. That's the game to me. If they can get to the finals, Gio Gonzalez in the finals, I feel very good about that. I don't feel as comfortable that the U.S. is going to roll with Holland on the mound in maybe the semifinals.
No, you're right. If it's Derek Holland versus either Kenta Maeda or Masahiro Tanaka, I might rather have Maeda or Tanaka than Holland. I'm not the biggest Holland fan in the world. He's a solid starting pitcher, but yeah, just in terms of the present ability, I might take Maeda or Tanaka over Holland.
I'm with you, Ben. I think that's a great way to put it. I think you both are on point, because to me, so much of it for the U.S., you don't want to look too far ahead. You've got to win this game on the 14th against the Dominican. That's a must win for me, because like you said, then that can allow you to crew. You're already set. You've got Vogelsong for the seeding game. I think you'd rather be the champion of Pool 2. You'd rather advance the easy way.
Absolutely.
Be the champion, and then you play the Netherlands, and the Netherlands is good. Great infield defense, and if, especially if they can get healthy, we'll see if Roger Bernardina can return, if Vladimir Valentin can return. I think DeCaster's probably not going to return. Do you guys think Jurickson Profar, if he's added, the Dallas Morning News, Evan Grant reported possibility of Profar being added. I keep checking his Twitter for news of that. I haven't found it yet. How big of a difference could Profar make for the Netherlands? Does getting Jurickson Profar make them, I think it makes them a better team. Does it make them more of a contender to win the championship, or do you feel like getting to the semifinals is kind of as far as they can go? Ben, why don't you answer that first?
I think it would be a huge addition for them, especially given the injuries they have. I'm not sure where they would put him.
Best guess I have is DH.
Yeah, I think right. They just slide him in at DH, to be honest with you, Ben, because their infield defense has been a strength. I don't know that you'd want to mess up the kind of the chemistry that Scope and Simmons have shown so far, because those guys are ridiculous as a double play combination.
Yeah, Scope's botched a couple balls. I mean, just a you're right. Maybe you might want to keep the chemistry together with Simmons and Scope that they have on the double play combination. I think as a defender, I would put, just in terms of the raw talent, I'd probably put Profar at second.
No,
and maybe Scope to the outfield, or maybe move Scope to third base, something where he's played more often than Xander Bogaerts. You could put Bogaerts at DH. But yeah, bottom line is if you put Profar in that lineup, I think that makes them a much more dangerous team, especially if they're, you know, going to be without, you know, we'll see what the status of Ballantyne is, some of the stuff, but yeah, you put Profar on that lineup, that's a huge addition.
And JJ, I mean, to me, it would be, I think you're probably right, because Bogaerts is playing first base, third base, really for the first time in an extended period in games that matter. And so if you move Scope to third, Profar at second, and if you could somehow put Bogaerts in the outfield, I doubt the Red Sox would allow that. But anything that you could do to keep from playing in a winner-take-all kind of game with Randolph Odubert in left field, even though he did steal three bases the other day in a game, but he went 1-for-4. You're basically giving away some, I think he had 3 strikeouts. But that to me, JJ, makes it all the more impressive that the Dutch have gotten there. And probably the biggest out of the entire WBC for me was Luke Van Mill striking out Frederick Cepeda. I mean, Frederick Cepeda, in the Cuban version of the word, is the most professional hitter on their team. He's the one. He's the guy who shortens up. He's the guy who's not all-or-nothing swing. He has an incredible he has an all-or-nothing swing less often than his compatriots. And he has an incredible World Baseball Classic and international track record. And Van Mill struck him out with the go-ahead run at third base on one out. I mean, that was huge. But to me, the Dutch team, I think getting to the semifinal, I don't think they could win it. Do you think they could beat, just for example, either the Dominican or the U.S. and then Japan in back-to-back games?
No. And I don't think they have much chance at all, to be honest with you. I think it's a great accomplishment to make the semifinals. I mean, tip of the cap. I think at this point you are looking at 3 teams that can win it. And I know we're ruling out Italy and Puerto Rico, you know, when they haven't even been eliminated. But I do think you're looking at the Dominican, the U.S., or Japan. Any one of those 3 could win it. I think that's really kind of the 3 to watch. Before we wrap up, I did also want to ask y'all, because I found it was kind of interesting. You know, here in Phoenix, Bud Selig kind of held an impromptu press conference. And in it, he mentioned that with the WBC, he kept repeating, he must have said at least 6 times, the goal is to grow the game internationally. He kept repeating that and made the point, like, look, the TV ratings actually for the WBC have been very good for MLB Network. It's been some of the best ratings MLB Network's ever had. But his point being, if this is a success in the U.S. or not, is not really the main point. The main point is a success internationally. Is it grow baseball internationally? Does it allow us to distribute money internationally to help grow the game, all that? But then he said, really, the long-term goal is he wants to see a true World Series. And I just kind of wanted to hear what you guys thought about that, the idea of – and we asked him to clarify, and it, really what it seemed like was, at least at the start, would be, okay, you take your U.S. champion, you take your Japanese champion, not an all-star team, but you take actually your team and you play a series between them. It's going to be a ways away, he said. I mean, we're talking – after, it's not going to be while he's commissioner, he said, and we all know at this point that Bud's going to be commissioner probably till 2050. So you know, it's going to be a while. But I wondered what you guys thought about the idea of a true World Series.
Ben, why don't you?
It's not really going to be a global World Series. I mean, you're going to have what, MLB versus
NPB,
the champion of Nippon Professional Baseball. You're not going to get the Dominican League and the Venezuelan League. That would be kind of silly, right?
I don't think you can call it a World Series. If you wanted to call it, though, I think the idea of the matchup is pretty interesting. But yeah, the problem is, as we've seen with the World Baseball Classic, there is no real chance, because of logistics, that you can ever put together what you would call close to a true World Championship, because for one, the seasons do not match up. I mean, this would be even like logistically difficult about having the U.S. champ versus the Japan champ, in that the Japan series they run their season runs longer than the U.S. So you would have to have the U.S. one, either they would have to move their season end up, or the U.S. one would have to kind of stay fresh for a couple of weeks after their World Series is over, which seems unlikely. And then you threw in, like, yeah, if you said, okay, but we're also going to have the best Dominican team, well, if you do that, that team could have a guy from the, you know, from the U.S. World Champ, so that doesn't work in some ways. There are a lot of hurdles involved, but the idea of a U.S. Japan Champ series that mattered does intrigue me. But yeah, I don't think it'd be a true World Series.
Yeah, I just can't see the logistics happening. There's too many games. The U.S. teams play too many games. You know, Japan's schedule actually seems like it makes a little bit more sense. 140 games, they have more days off. But the season lasts longer there, like you said, like it goes later into the year, probably because they wear everybody out in spring training. But
would you bring in like the champions from Serie Nacional and the KBO? And
that's what I'm saying. I don't think that's I agree with you, Ben. I just don't think it's workable. But I do think I think we probably all agree that this tournament, while imperfect, has a lot of good parts to it, and that there's room for refinement with the WBC, but I think it's got a lot of things going for it that are positive, and I think that I feel like it has some positive momentum, even though I think this year the talent on the teams was a little down compared to past years. Maybe I'm a little off there, but you know, no Felix Hernandez makes me just think Venezuela wasn't as good. They didn't even advance out of the first round. I mean, the Dominican doesn't really have an ace pitcher like they've had in past tournaments. But it still feels like it's been a very entertaining tournament. You had the brawl we didn't even talk about, which was kind of showed some of the ferocity and the passion of this game. We had the all-time greatest WBC quote coming from Larry Walker, that he saw Satan in Alfredo Aceves' eyes. I mean, I feel like it's been a fun tournament, and I feel like there's better things to come for the WBC going forward.
I think it's definitely – the other thing I think has happened is that what we've seen this year is proof that, you know, this is a more competitive tournament than maybe a lot of people thought. I think that's what's important about the Netherlands doing what they've done and Italy doing what it's done and all, is that this isn't something where when they roll this around again in 2017 – that there can be any argument made, oh, well, you know, most of these teams are just pushovers, and really it's only a two- or three-team tournament. We've seen it's not a two- or three-team tournament. I mean, South Korea, who has been as dominant in this thing as anyone besides Japan, can't make it out of the first round. Venezuela doesn't make it out of the first round. Italy makes it to the second round. There's just a lot of signs of the growing competitive, you know, the competition around the world is getting better. And the other thing is that I think the brawl in hindsight is going to be one of the important things that ever happened in WBC history, because it gave people more attention for the, you know, I still see things, you know, places where it's being talked about now. There are not a whole lot of WBC occurrences that you have a whole lot of people talking about days after it happened. And that does stand out as something where I do think there is some positive momentum going on here.
I think so, too. Fun tournament, guys. Great stuff. And we have more to come, obviously. Walter Villa down in Miami covering the Pool 2. I'll be wrapping up in San Francisco. Looking forward to that. And, guys, great coverage from you guys from Phoenix and from Fukuoka. So look forward to more. Look forward to previews for the finals and for the prospect wrap-up when it's all done. So. Thanks for making the time, guys.
Hey, thank you. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks for all the WBC fandom we've seen out there.
Absolutely. And, Ben, we're going to have to talk again soon about the international stuff, and I wanted to get your take on Ian Gordon's article on Mother Jones for a future podcast. So we'll get that done, too.
Sure.
So for Ben and for JJ, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next time on the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.